Today is Wednesday, January 30th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington, filling in for Lori London. Coming up, the U.S. is warning Venezuela not to block opposition leader Juan Guaido from leaving the country. We'll meet a woman photographing cancer survivors.
They changed their outlook in life and said, yeah, this is me, and I'm a survivor. So you see the transformation going on while I photograph them.
And we'll hear how the Trump administration's intel chiefs see today's global threats. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton warned Venezuela's Attorney General that there may be serious consequences after the prosecutor asked the country's Supreme Court to keep opposition leader Juan Guaido from leaving the country. Meanwhile, Bolton has raised questions about the United States' intentions in Venezuela. Reuters' Nathan Frandino has more.
5,000 troops to Colombia. Those words scrawled in clear view on the notepad of White House National Security Advisor John Bolton as tensions soar between the U.S. and Venezuela are raising questions whether the U.S. might be planning to dispatch U.S. forces to its South American ally. Photos of the pad quickly circulated online.
Good afternoon.
After Bolton appeared in the White House briefing room to announce new sanctions against Venezuela's state-owned oil firm PDVSA. President Donald Trump's latest step pressuring socialist President Nicolas Maduro to leave office. It remained unclear Tuesday what Bolton's notes meant or if flashing the notes in front of reporters was intentional. One U.S. official told Reuters they, quote, have seen nothing to support Bolton's notes. But a White House spokesman said, as the president has said, all options are on the table. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan suggested he was in the dark.
Yeah, I haven't discussed that with Secretary Bolton.
As was Colombian Foreign Minister Carlos Holmes Trujillo.
The reason and importance of said annotation is unknown.
The U.S. already has some military in Colombia, but they're part of a pre-existing partnership. The notepad mystery comes as Venezuela grapples with a power struggle between Maduro and opposition leader Juan Guaido, who proclaimed himself interim president last week with Trump's backing. Any additional military troops would sharply escalate those tensions. Maduro has already warned Trump to stay away.
Donald Trump, hands off Venezuela.
The U.S. has given Guaido authority to control certain assets held by the Federal Reserve Bank on behalf of the Venezuelan people.
That's Reuters' Nathan Frandino reporting. Among the top stories in the world, a suicide attack against a police facility in Pakistan has killed at least 9 people and injured 21 others. Afghans are concerned about their future as the U.S. makes progress in talks with the Taliban. Brazilian police arrested 5 people Tuesday in connection with last week's dam collapse. The death toll now stands at 84. The Pentagon is preparing to send additional troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
In a minute.
A recent U.S.-Dutch study outlined evidence that the Antarctic ice sheet is losing about 6 times the ice each year than it did back 40 years ago. Now, another new study suggests that accelerating ice melt is also taking place in Greenland, which is mostly located within the Arctic Circle. The study proposes that Greenland ice is melting faster than had been thought and that it could lead to a faster rise in sea level. The researchers place the blame of the accelerated ice loss on what they call the increasing warming of Earth's atmosphere. Since most of southwest Greenland, the area the researchers focused on, doesn't have glaciers, the study proposes that the lost ice must be actual surface ice. The study found that the largest continuous loss of Greenland ice took place from early 2003 to mid-2013. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
A I'm Jim Bertel, sitting in for Lori London, and this is VOA's International Edition. President Trump's longtime friend Roger Stone went before a judge in Washington Tuesday to plead not guilty to the 7 charges outlined in an indictment last week. The indictment is part of the special counsel's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election. Joining me is VOA's Masood Farivar. Masood, explain the charges against Mr. Stone.
Roger Stone has been charged with 7 criminal offenses, and they include 5 counts of making false statements to Congress, 1 count of witness tampering, and 1 count of obstructing a congressional investigation. Now, all these charges relate to a congressional investigation into Stone's contacts with WikiLeaks during the 2016 campaign, at the time he was campaigning for then-candidate Donald Trump.
Now, do the charges against Stone allege coordination with Russia or with WikiLeaks on the release of the hacked emails?
That's an interesting question. It depends on what you mean by coordination. If by coordination you mean that Roger Stone actually contacted WikiLeaks and contacted the Trump campaign to find out and let them know what was going on and when the next email batch was coming, yes, there was that kind of coordination going on. But the indictment does not allege any criminal conspiracy, does not allege any criminal conduct on the part of Roger Stone. However, the absence of evidence does not mean the evidence of absence. Special counsel could well have other evidence to bring additional charges involving conspiracy between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks and Russia. We simply don't know at this time.
Okay, well, the charging documents against Stone say that at one point, a senior Trump campaign official was directed to contact Stone about any additional releases and damaging information WikiLeaks had about Clinton. Is the arrest of Stone seen as a step towards bigger fish?
Not necessarily. Simply directing a senior campaign official to contact Roger Stone to find out what WikiLeaks was going to publish is not criminal in and of itself. However, if the campaign knew the emails were stolen and that encouraged WikiLeaks or the Russians to publish stolen emails, that's a different question. We simply don't know at this point what the special counsel knows about any criminal activity on the part of Trump campaign's associates.
Well, yesterday we learned from acting U.S. Attorney General Matthew Whitaker that he thinks the special counsel's investigation into Russian interference is coming to a close very, very soon. Is an announcement like that unusual? And what do we know about Mueller's timeline for wrapping up the investigation?
The announcement was unusual. It's very unusual for an attorney general or an acting attorney general to talk in those terms about an open investigation. He, I think, kind of hedged his statements by saying, I think, I hope. We don't know at this point what the time frame is, but the special counsel seems to be moving very rapidly towards completing the investigation. The grand jury is actively seeking testimony from witnesses. The prosecutors recently executed search warrants at 3 places, all of which indicate that the investigation is active, but we don't know when it's going to wind down.
Okay, this may be the million-dollar question. How likely is the report to be made public?
That is a million-dollar question. We don't know. The incoming attorney general, William Barr, has indicated that he may not make public all the details of the report because of certain Justice Department regulations that discourage the department from criticizing individuals that have not been charged. Now, the Democrats in Congress recently proposed a bill that would require the Attorney General to make the final report public. The incoming Attorney General Barr indicated during his recent confirmation hearing that he might share a summary of the final report. We don't know if he will make a commitment to Democrats in Congress to release the entire report. We'll see.
Masoud Farivar, thank you for your insight. The UN Children's Fund is launching its largest ever appeal for nearly $4 billion in life-saving assistance for 73 million people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of UNICEF's 2019 Global Appeal.
This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The UN Children's Fund says 2019 also marks a year of heightened conflict, with more countries at war than at any time in the past three decades. Among the greatest victims are more than 34 million children affected by conflict or disaster. UNICEF says they are suffering horrific levels of violence, deprivation, and trauma, with little access to protection and life-saving assistance. UNICEF Director of Emergency Operations, Manuel Fontaine, says 88% of this year's appeal is for humanitarian crises driven by conflict. He says the single biggest operation is to help Syrian refugees, the largest displacement crisis in the world, and the host communities in five neighboring countries of asylum.
The second largest appeal is for Yemen, which over the past year has seen conditions, unfortunately, that were already catastrophic for children, get even worse, if that's possible. 8 out of 10 children, which is over 11 million, now require humanitarian assistance in Yemen.
UNICEF's biggest operations traditionally have been in Africa, but this year, the Democratic Republic of Congo places third, followed by Syria and South Sudan. Fontaine says Africa, unfortunately, is the continent with the biggest gap in funding. He tells VOA African countries are not getting the attention they need, and that has serious consequences for humanitarian operations.
In a country like Cameroon, which is one of the countries for which we have concerns, particularly in the northwest and southwest region at the moment, we had aimed to immunize 61,000 children against measles, and because of lack of resources, we could only immunize a bit more than 2,000. So obviously, we're far behind where we needed to do.
Fontaine says UNICEF has had to drastically cut back services for gender-based violence in Central African Republic because it only has received 36% of the money it needs. In all cases, he says, funding shortfalls have very direct implications on the lives of children and women. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And this is VOA's International Edition. A tweet from a U.S. government scientific agency has led to a dispute about global warming on social media. It followed an earlier tweet by President Trump. Joining me is VOA's White House Bureau Chief, Steve Herman. So, Steve, a couple of tweets started the latest debate about climate change.
Yes, the president on Monday evening, and this wasn't the first time that Donald Trump has tweeted about his skepticism of climate change or global warming, as he calls it. And that was coming amid a time right now, Jim, where temperatures are just falling rapidly across the United States as this polar vortex is Arctic deep freeze comes into the Midwest in the eastern part of the United States.
With this polar vortex coming down, and in some places the high temperatures will be below zero Fahrenheit, how do scientists balance out this extreme cold with their claims of global warming?
Well, as one U.S. government scientific agency posted on Twitter after the president's tweet, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that winter storms do not prove global warming is not happening. It explained that severe snowstorms may even be more likely in a warming global climate because higher ocean temperatures appear to create more moisture. And you have more moisture in the winter when things are freezing and the clouds are full, and then you're going to get more snow.
With NOAA's response to the president's tweet, do you expect the president's view on global warming and climate change to switch?
Absolutely not, Jim. there's the bulk of the science community and all of the pushback that the president has received, not just this week, but for a long time on social media and in the mainstream media and on television, including the channels that he watches regularly have not swayed the president on this at all.
Now, I know NOAA is saying that their tweet was not in response to the president's, but yet it contradicts what he said in his tweet. Is it unusual for a federal government agency to contradict the position of the president?
Well, yes and no. In past administrations, we rarely saw something like this, but I think we should note that it's not only the scientists, but there was on Tuesday a congressional hearing with the heads of the various intelligence agencies, and much of what they were stating on various global threats also really contradicted some of the president's avowed positions on how he perceives global threats and negotiations and progress with the North Koreans, for example.
And we'll be discussing that hearing today with Jeff Selden in just a few minutes. Steve Herman, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Jim, anytime.
And this is VOA's International Edition.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel, filling in for Lori London. U.S. intelligence chiefs are sounding alarms about an ever more perilous future for the United States, one in which the country is in danger of seeing its influence wane. They raise these concerns while testifying before Congress. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden monitored the hearing and is here with the highlights. Jeff, the intel chiefs seem to contradict President Trump on a number of global security concerns. Let's begin with North Korea.
Well, with North Korea, the intelligence chiefs, notably Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, the Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, General Robert Ashley, and also the CIA Director, Gina Haspel, all reiterated longstanding intelligence concerns about whether North Korea is fully committed to getting rid of its entire nuclear arsenal. And what Coates said, what Haspel said, what Ashley said, is that all signs point to the fact that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un does see value in talking to the U.S., does think that North Korea gets something out of it, perhaps as a better path forward for his nation, but also that the regime still seems to believe, from all the indications that U.S. intelligence analysts have seen, that it needs and is going to maintain at least some nuclear weapons, that it does want to have the ability to point a nuclear warhead at the U.S. and be able to launch it and reach the U.S.
That's a little scary. There were a number of items that were covered, so we want to keep going. Despite the Trump administration claiming that the Islamic State has been defeated, the intel chiefs delivered a very different assessment today.
Well, what they did was they delivered a more nuanced assessment. Often in the politics of Washington and sometimes what you hear from the White House, there's talk of the defeat of the Islamic State. What the intelligence chief said is that what has been defeated really is the self-declared caliphate, which once controlled large swaths of land across Iraq and Syria, now down to just a couple of small villages in Syria. But what they said was that the Islamic State still commands thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria, that it still has active affiliates with the capacity to launch attacks in their regions and also with the ambition to launch some attacks against the West. And they said it would be a mistake to underestimate the resolve of the Islamic State to try to resurge and eventually recapture territory.
All right, let's turn now to Iran. President Trump pulled out of the deal that was negotiated during the Obama administration, and yet the intel chiefs testified that the nuclear deal is actually working.
They testified that Iran, for now, is abiding with the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. And if you look at the report that they put out that came along with the hearing, it's the annual Worldwide Threat Assessment Report. Intelligence analysts believe at this point, if Iran was to shift gears, it would still take it about a year to develop a nuclear warhead that it could use. So they said that Iran's adhering to the deal. The deterrence is still there for now. But they also noted that Iran and Iranian leaders are making a lot of noise, and that they're suggesting if they don't get all the economic benefits they wanted from the deal, and remember, some of those benefits disappeared when Trump pulled the U.S. out of the agreement, and that also the U.S. and Europe have imposed some new sanctions on Iran because of their ballistic missile testing, that they may decide to change course. The other criticism of the deal that's come from the Trump administration is that because of the money freed up under the deal, Iran was being more aggressive with its support of terrorist groups, with its support of proxies around the world. The intelligence chiefs also testified Iran is continuing that activity. And in fact, in Iraq, as the government begins to stabilize with the disappearance of some of the pressure from the Islamic State, since they only have cells right now operating, they don't control any territory, the biggest threat to the U.S. in Iraq and to U.S. troops and personnel in the Middle East may still be Iran, whether it's from their the Iranian Shia-backed militias, or even some pressure on the high seas.
VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Thank you for joining us today on International Edition. Undocumented Rosa Gutierrez-Lopez had been ordered to leave the country by December 10th when she sought refuge at a Bethesda, Maryland church to avoid being deported back to El Salvador and leave her three American-born children behind. As Bill Rogers reports, she is the latest publicly known sanctuary case in a movement that has expanded since the Trump administration took office 2 years ago.
At the Cedar Lane Unitarian Universalist Church, it's a typical Sunday morning. Members arrive to hear the church's progressive message and calls to help those in need, especially the undocumented Salvadoran woman living here in sanctuary. This church is Rosa Gutierrez Lopez's last hope.
I have faith that I'm going to be able to stay here so I can fight for my children. I have a boy with Down syndrome who has a lot of special needs.
Officially welcomed at a church ceremony in mid-December, Rosa sought refuge after federal authorities ordered her to leave the country.
Mi nombre es Rosa Inés Gutiérrez López.
The mother of three American-born children, she's seeking asylum because of gang violence in El Salvador. Wearing a government monitoring device, she says only her daughter understands why she can't leave church grounds.
El niño que tiene síndrome, él no sabe.
My boy with Down syndrome doesn't know that I'm in this situation. And my boy, who's nine, he knows I'm in this place, but he doesn't understand exactly why. But my daughter, who's 11, she does know. She tells me, Mommy, I miss you. I want you to be in our home. But I tell her I can't, because if I leave the church, immigration will grab me and deport me.
Yo le digo, no puedo estar, porque si yo salgo de la iglesia, migración me va a agarrar, me va a deportar.
I believe her and her children, her American children, would be in grave danger.
Hector Perez Casillas is Rosa's lawyer.
They would be immediately targeted because they know that, A, she's been here in the United States for so long, B, she has American children, and C, one of them is ill, making her an extra vulnerable target.
Rosa is now one of 50 people known publicly to be living in sanctuary churches across the country. That number has grown since President Trump took office, and so has the number of congregations offering sanctuary, from 400 in 2017 to 1,100 today, according to Church World Service. While sanctuary congregations may fear government raids, for now immigration authorities are following long-standing guidelines barring agents from entering churches, schools, or hospitals. Hardline immigration advocate Stephen Camerota agrees with these guidelines, but criticizes the sanctuary movement.
It's understandable why in any individual case you might say, well, couldn't we make an exception for this nice guy, this nice lady? And I think everyone, I think, feels a lot of sympathy for that. But when you do that, you end up with the scale of illegal immigration that we now have.
Bill Rogers for VOA News, Bethesda, Maryland.
And from Bethesda, we move a little further north in Maryland to meet an artist named Linda McCarthy. She takes all kinds of photos, school students, family portraits, and headshots. Last year, McCarthy started a new photography project, Survivors. It focuses on women who survived or are being treated for breast cancer. Faith Lapidus tells us more about this project and the survivors.
Cheryl Listman, a single mother who works in financing, is one of the 20 women participating in the Survivors Project.
I was diagnosed in 2013, and I had a 40% chance of survival with stage 2B breast cancer.
Listman didn't give up and kept fighting the disease. She met photographer Linda McCarthy through friends.
I work with women. I help educate women who are going through the journey and just, you know, help them navigate through the medical side of it. And when she asked me, I thought, wow, maybe it's just another impact that I could have on women, you know. And then also I would be able to look back at those photos and see how far I've came.
McCarthy says the idea of a project featuring breast cancer survivors came to her when she was searching for a ballerina to photograph for her portfolio.
I was introduced to Maggie, who is known as the bald ballerina. She was diagnosed at the age of 23 with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. So I met with her and I asked if I could photograph her, not as a ballerina, but as a beautiful girl who happens to have breast cancer. You look gorgeous. Okay, turn around. Just pick up a skirt and then just rock on one side. There you go. Beautiful. And then chin out.
McCarthy says she wanted to put faces on this disease.
I wanted to photograph them as whole women, not the parts that they see of themselves. And I didn't want scars and I didn't want anything like that, but I wanted them to see how beautiful they are. They changed their outlook in life and said, yeah, this is me, and I'm a survivor. So you see the transformation going on while I photograph them.
Each participant goes through a consultation and a session with makeup artist Victoria Ronan.
In some cases, it's been a very long time since they've had makeup on. It's been a very long time since they've done something for themselves.
Ronan says by the end of the session, many of these women are surprised and delighted.
I've had a lot of women look in the mirror and just start tearing up because they can't believe how beautiful I've made them look.
When fighting breast cancer, Listman says, it's helpful to feel beautiful.
It's very important. Because when you go through a horrific journey and treatment, you don't feel beautiful.
Photographing breast cancer survivors for free is just one aspect of the Survivors Project. With the help of some local businesses, McCarthy organized a fundraiser.
During that evening, I had all my photographs displayed and all of my breast cancer survivors there, as many as can attend. We raised over $5,000 that night for our local hospital and their breast cancer center, which is the Rebecca Fortney Breast Center.
McCarthy says the positive feedback has motivated her to continue the project, hoping that one day she'll write a book about her experience capturing survivors in photographs. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. My thanks to our studio team, Director Tracy Carter, Engineer John Ellison. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for listening.
This is VOA News. I'm